You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Coming up, John Vucetich explains why wolf hunting is on hold in Michigan. But first, 4 months ago, West Southwest reported on the launch of a major initiative to curb Kalamazoo County's high rate of black babies dying in their first year of life. A lot has happened since. For starters, a follow-up brainstorming session earlier this month drew more than 100 people, showing community interest remains high. Also this month, the importance of the issue of black infant mortality was recognized by the Michigan Association of Broadcasters when it awarded WMUK the Best Public Affairs Program for Public Radio for West Southwest segment with YWCA CEO Grace Lumwama on last November's launch of the Kalamazoo Infant Mortality Community Initiative. Today, I'm back with an update. We talked to Lumwama and initiative partners Catherine Kattari, Director of Community Research at the Western Michigan University School of Medicine, and Lucinda Stinson, Deputy Director of Community Services for the Kalamazoo County Health and Community Services. We'll delve deeper into what the local data is revealing so far and what came out of the recent follow-up meeting and what the next steps are. Kattari starts us off with an overview of the problem of black infant mortality in Kalamazoo County.
Over the last 20 years, black infants have been dying at 2 to 3 times higher rate than white infants. That problem has actually gotten worse over the last 10 years, and it's gotten worse over a period of time when the county as a whole's infant mortality rate has actually gone down. If we look at all of the births in Kalamazoo County, we're actually very close to meeting the Healthy People 2020 goal of 6 infant deaths per 1,000 births. Unfortunately, not everybody is seeing those same gains. Black infants in Kalamazoo County during a 3-year period of 2010 to 2012 died at 4.5 times the rate of white infants here in Kalamazoo County. The disparity between black and white infant deaths has actually gotten worse during the period of time when the overall county infant deaths have actually gone down.
I know it's early in your data collection process for this initiative, but are you getting any sense of why black babies are dying at a higher rate than white babies?
The very first thing that we look at that is the strongest reason for infant mortality and for health disparities in that mortality is often poverty. And it's living in conditions of poverty where there's not enough access to care, where there's not enough access to healthy foods, healthy living, safe environments for infants to sleep. And so the very first thing we looked at when we started examining this issue of black infant mortality here in Kalamazoo County is the degree to which poverty explains that. And what we find is that in some communities, once you take into account poverty, you've basically explained the disparity that has to do with race because so many black women are much more likely to be living in poverty. That is the case here in Kalamazoo, given in that 85% of the black women giving birth here in Kalamazoo are living in conditions of poverty. And so that is much higher than the 30% of white women who've given birth here in Kalamazoo County living in poverty. What we know is that women who live in poverty are much more likely to deliver low birth weight babies. In fact, women who are poor have twice as great a likelihood of delivering a low birth weight infant as women who are not poor. In Kalamazoo, women who are black have an additional chance of delivering a low birth weight baby of an increase of 1.7. Those two problems here in Kalamazoo County are each independent. They each add risk. So that means that a poor black woman is 3.7 times more likely to deliver a low birth weight infant here in Kalamazoo County.
Grace Lumwama, you wanted to say something?
I think what we have done since we last met is really looked at secondary data. You know, Kathy and the university have done a great job working with the county to look at the data that we already have, the data that has been already collected, to really start identifying those real issues. you know, a lot of people keep saying, we don't have the data. The data is already there. So the team has been working hard to look at that secondary data and point out what the real issues are.
Thank you, Grace. We really need to address issues of poverty, but we also need to, there's a degree of risk that's associated simply with being Black in Kalamazoo County. And that's what's really important for us to understand. What we've done also is dig a little deeper to find out what is it that's associated, what are the sort of risks that are associated with being Black versus the kind of risks that are associated with being poor. And what we have found is that a lot of the infant deaths that occur among infants that actually leave the hospital and go home, those deaths, they're much more likely to be related to sleep-related environment. So sleep-related deaths are a very strong focus of public health efforts, not only here in Kalamazoo County, but across the state and across the nation. And those are deaths that are due to infants sleeping in unsafe sleep environments, such as on couches, sleeping with others, whether they're additional siblings or whether they're with adults, or sleeping in areas where there's blankets or cribs or toys. Here in Kalamazoo County, those sleep-related deaths and sleep-related risks are very much associated with being poor. Poverty explains a large majority of those sleep-related deaths. And that's really important to know, and it can really inform our action and what we need to do. The deaths that are associated with being Black in Kalamazoo, however, are not necessarily around sleep-related deaths. They have to do with issues that have to do with mom's health before pregnancy as well as during pregnancy. And that's her health and well-being. And that speaks to things like her nutrition, having a planned pregnancy, having a healthy pregnancy that does include prenatal care, but it's not exclusive to prenatal care. And one of the things that we know in general about being Black in the United States is that it's often associated with a feeling as if you're in a lower class status. You're not as valued. The level of stress that's associated with being a lower class citizen is what accounts for a lot of the lack of health and well-being among women and among Black people in general, and is associated with mortality and morbidity, no matter what your age.
I know that Lucinda Stinson with Kalamazoo County Health and Community Services can give us an overview on what happened when you had a follow-up meeting bringing the community together.
Once we did the first initial meeting, and we've had several subsequent meetings with our community partners and our key stakeholders, we identified early on, looking at Kathy's information, some of the five key areas that we really needed to address. When we looked at the data, and then we looked at the issue surrounding the data, we collectively said, okay, based on that data, let's pick out five key areas and let that be our focus. Those five key areas were infant safety, as Kathy has indicated, maternal well-being, infant well-being, women's empowerment, and strengthening families. So what we did, we decided that we wanted to hear from our community to see what their perceptions were of those five key categories. We actually broke out into five work groups, and we had our key stakeholders facilitating the work groups and asking them the question regarding the gaps. So where are the gaps when it comes to infant safety? Where are the gaps when it comes to maternal well-being? And we came up with some interesting feedback. For example, for the gaps in regards to infant safety, we looked at the agencies and the resources we have in the community. As a community, as a whole, Kalamazoo is wealthy in resources, but we have a tendency of working in silos. We need to bring those groups together because we do have the collective good of the community. We need to do more follow-up after discharge. For example, a gap that was identified was one of our local health agencies actually has a great program regarding car infant safety. They gave out about 600 car seats last year, but there was no follow-up. So all those women that received car seats for their children, great. They were in the category of meeting the need to qualify for those seats, but they're also the women that are losing the babies. Social services, Kathy talked about stress. We need to look at how we can reduce that stress, and the stress also associated with racism. Infant well-being, how can we effectively navigate this complex system? If you don't know how to navigate the medical maze and you come into the system poor and at a level of stress, we need to make sure that we are proactive with the pregnant women, making sure they are connected to the resources. after their discharge, making sure they have quality health, quality health care, yes, and quality child care, so that they can raise that healthy child. Again, we go back to race. Our primary care providers predominantly are white. Do they understand the complexities of being black and poor in this community? So it comes back to cultural competency. Dignity and respect, that's critical. We can go into a provider, we can hand them our Blue Cross and Blue Shield card and be treated one way, but you go into a provider and hand them your Medicaid card, there's a difference in the treatment.
Let's shift now to Grace Lumbwama. That meeting that you had on March 12th, was there any surprises? And tell me about what we're doing moving forward.
I've really been impressed by this community. This is a community that is very proactive. This is a community that really loves the children and families that live in this place. You know, when we talk about infant mortality, it's such a complex issue. And when you talk about a really community holistic engagement and building a strategy that is going to turn this issue around, it's also very complex. So I was really impressed to see a group of individuals who are really committed to this movement. And as we talk about the collective impact, which is a Stanford framework that came around a couple of years ago that they're using to really talk about community transformation, that's the framework that this initiative is going to use. So we are going to use a collective impact framework whereby we always have the voice of the community. We want to hear from the women that have been affected with this issue. So we will continue working with the community, working with a group of key stakeholders that will do the hard work, the planning, the strategy, and then going back to the community and presenting that strategy, hearing the feedback from the community, going back to the table and then digging and working hard to make sure we come up with a very intentional strategy.
You're listening to West Southwest. We've been hearing from YWCA CEO Grace Lumbwama, WMU Medical School's Catherine Katari, and Lucinda Stinson from the Kalamazoo County Health and Community Services on the latest on an effort in Kalamazoo County to reduce black infant mortality. Coming up, you'll hear Katari answering my question about what can be done now as the committee continues its work.
There's a lot of action that can be currently taken around safe sleep and around infant health and safety. Where we are with regards to maternal health and the excessive black infant deaths that are linked to being born premature, being born too little, being born too early, that actually accounts for the vast majority of the disparity, the racial disparity, our deaths that occur that are attributed to being born premature. There's a lot we don't know, and that's where a lot of the complexity comes in, because there's a lot of reasons that may be attributed to this, and they include the stress of living poor, the stress of living black. These are women who also have had prior infant losses. One of the things that we need to do is align a lot of these maternal infant home visitation programs, which can be so effective. We need to align them and make sure that women who can most benefit from them are the women with the highest risk.
Grace Lumbwama, I think you wanted to add something on the issue of what can be done now.
Two things that I really want us to do in Kalamazoo that we did in Los Angeles and were very, very effective. One of them is we were very intentional on who we were targeting. So when we are talking about the infant mortality high amongst African Americans, our focus was intentional. We focused on African American mothers. So we looked at all the programs that we had in our community and said, if we have a Healthy Start program, if we have the nursing visitation program, are those programs really recruiting African-American clients into their programs?
I definitely support what Grace is saying, because again, we need those resources. But when we look back at the history, about 15, 20 years ago, we effectively managed reducing infant mortality in this community. And we did that the same way through key stakeholders. What happened was funding. Funding was reduced or eliminated. People need to understand that we've done this. We can repeat it. We need to repeat it. We need to get our key stakeholders to the point where we can collaboratively go after some of those dollars to help fund more people or more navigators going into the homes and helping navigate women through their pregnancy, helping them navigate through the healthcare system. We need to increase those number of people that are doing Healthy Babies, Healthy Start, nurse-family partnerships.
Grace Lumbwama?
The other point I wanted to bring out is really streamlining and having a triage process. Those are going to be very, very key in us helping the right clientele, you know, the women that we're trying to target, really have a streamlined process or a triage. What we did in Los Angeles, which was really exciting, is we knew of every bath in that community. We had a nurse at a hospital. We were unfortunate. We only had one bathing hospital in that community. So we had a nurse at the hospital that did the triage for all our high-risk women and figured out what is the best program for these women. And whoever of those women did not fit in any of the programs we had in the community, we had a case manager that was part of the collaborative we had built that followed those women.
Who are some of your key stakeholders? And do you think some people may say, why will it be successful? What would you say to that? Anyone who wants to jump in?
Some of our key stakeholders, of course, are the hospitals, Borges and Bronson, and we have the Family Health Center, our local federally qualified health clinic. We have the faith-based community. We have education, our education community, KRESA, Head Start, the Great Start Collaborative, KC Ready 4, WMED, of course, is a key player. We have them at the table now, and I know I'm missing some, and I apologize for that. But right now, and this may sound cliche-ish, but because we have good data, because we have a good mechanism for articulating that data by working with Kathy Gattari and her years of experience on researching this particular project, because we've heightened the awareness of what it is that we're trying to do, and it gets down to the basics. We're losing our children.
Final thoughts, Ms. Gattari.
We've got all the folks at the table who are actually conducting the home visits as well as the providers. So we have the folks who are in a position to actually do and follow through on solutions within the clinic and within the home.
We'll give the final word to Grace Mbwama.
You know, this is an exciting time for Kalamazoo. As I'm walking within the community, even grocery shopping, people are calling me and are stopping me and asking me, what can I do? And I want to call on everybody who's listening. I think you have a role at the table. We want to hear your voice. There are babies in this community that are not celebrating their first birthday just because of things that we can change. We have a team of leaders in this community that are really committed to this effort, and we believe with that commitment, we're going to change this issue around in Kalamazoo.
The community is invited to the next public meeting of the Kalamazoo Infant Mortality Community Initiative on May 14th. For more details and for a longer version of this interview, visit our webpage at WMUK.org. For West Southwest, I'm Arlene McMichael.
This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. We're speaking with biologist John Vucetich about Michigan's debate over wolf hunting. Vucetich studies the wolf and moose populations of Isle Royale. He's also a professor at Michigan Technological University. Vucetich will be at Western Michigan University Thursday and Friday to talk about his research and the future of Michigan wolf hunting. We spoke about why that future is uncertain. John Vucetich, welcome back to West Southwest.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
Last year, 2014, saw a variety of issues come up regarding the status of wolves, both nationally and in Michigan in particular. I want to talk about each of those. So to start out, for one, Michigan allowed a wolf hunt in 2014, but from what I understand, it sounded like only about half of the number of wolves that they had said could be killed were killed. What ended up happening with that hunt?
Well, for that particular hunt, the Michigan Department of Natural Resources allowed for approximately 40 wolves to be killed. That's just an approximate number that gives the rough idea, though. And what in fact happened was that only about 20 were killed by hunters. And there are a variety of comments that can be made about that. Some people think, and I'd be inclined to agree, it suggests that Michiganders aren't really all that interested in killing wolves. If they were particularly interested in killing wolves as sport, they would have filled that quota. And another consideration, though, is that it was firearm only. There was no trapping allowed. And if trapping had been allowed, trapping is a much easier way to kill wolves, and they probably would have reached their quota if trapping had been allowed. And so if there are any prospects of hunting in the future or hunting or trapping in the future for wolves in Michigan, it would be something for citizens to be paying attention to. Do they allow traps or not?
Were the 20 or so wolves that were killed, were they all concentrated in one area?
They were spread out a little bit. I don't think the geographic spread of them was all that significant. The DNR would argue that they were tended to be killed around farms where livestock had been lost. I'm not so sure that that's a most useful characterization of where the wolves were killed.
All right. So there was the hunt that was allowed in 2014. Then in November, there were two questions on the ballot regarding future wolf hunts. Both failed, but from what I've read, that doesn't necessarily mean that wolf hunts won't happen in the future. What is the status of wolf hunting right now in Michigan?
Well, it's not allowed at the moment, and the reason that it's not allowed is a little bit complicated. There was, as you had mentioned, some referenda, and the referenda led to a situation where the Natural Resource Commission might have been able to allow hunting in a subsequent season. But what now prevents them from doing that is that there was litigation that also took place. This is a litigation that began some time ago, more than a year ago. The litigants included the Humane Society of the United States, and they sued the federal government. Now, not the state government, but the federal government. And they sued them over the idea of whether wolves belonged on the endangered species list or not. One thing is that you can't hunt wolves if they're on the federal endangered species list. They had been delisted. That allowed, in principle, for Michigan to go through the process of figuring out whether they wanted to hunt wolves or not. But when the Humane Society of the United States and others sued the federal government about whether wolves should be on the endangered species list or not, they won. And in winning, that put the wolves back on the endangered species list. And that means that it's the state of Michigan can do nothing about wolf hunting at this point in time. If it wanted to hunt wolves, it simply would not be allowed to by the federal law. And so that ruling by the federal judge to have wolves put back on the endangered species list is going to be challenged in two ways. One is that the states of Michigan and Wisconsin and the federal government are planning to appeal that decision by the judge. So this decision about whether wolves should be on the endangered species list or not will soon be heard by an appellate judge. The other thing that is happening more or less at the same time is that the United States Congress is considering passing a law, and that law would very specifically isolate wolves in the Upper Great Lakes area and for historical political reasons in the state of Wyoming. And it would say that wolves in those two areas will simply be delisted by fiat, if you will. And so depending on how those actions take place will determine whether Michigan can decide whether it wants to have wolf hunting or not. And so those things could, it's really difficult to predict the future. Some of those things could happen kind of quickly. Some of them could be a bit slow in coming in terms of knowing what Congress would do and in terms of knowing what how the litigation will play out.
When I look at the Michigan Department of Natural Resources page on wolves, the section on wolf hunts or harvests, as they put it, is framed in terms of resolving conflict issues between humans and wolves. And I gather from your interview last year with WMUK's Brian Peterson that you would take a couple of issues with that wording. Could you explain what you think of that rationale for wolf hunting?
Oh, sure. You know, the reasons that the Department of Natural Resources have offered for why we should have a wolf hunt is to reduce threats that wolves represent to humans and to livestock. And the notion and the basic idea is that if we are shooting at wolves, they'll be more afraid of people. And if we're shooting at wolves, they'll learn to stay away from livestock. And there's a couple of problems with all of this. One is that wolves simply are not a threat to humans, and it's irresponsible to suggest otherwise. And so then the idea that we're going to shoot at wolves for some threat that actually isn't real it's also irresponsible to predicate management on something that's simply not true. If if wolves were ever a threat to humans, then that would be such an important problem that you would want to deal with it immediately. You'd want to deal with it, you know, that same day, and you'd want to deal with it thoroughly, and you'd want to deal with it precisely. You'd want to find exactly the wolf that's causing the problem, and you'd want to remove that threat without any doubt. And hunting just doesn't seem like a sensible way to accomplish that. If there's a threat to human safety in April, you're going to wait until November and hope that some hunter has the good fortune of killing the wolf that was causing this threat. That doesn't make any sense at all. The Michigan DNR has for many years, you know, kept its finger on the pulse of instances where there might even be the perception of threat against humans. And in all these cases, they've dealt with them fine and without hunting. And that's the way to deal with that. Now, the question about livestock is a little bit similar and a little bit different to the human safety issue. The part that is different is that wolves do, in fact, kill livestock from time to time. And the concern, however, is hunting really the sensible way to deal with that threat? And there's quite a few reasons to think that hunting is not a sensible way to deal with that kind of threat. And it comes down to, well, a great deal of research has been done anyways on the relationship between wolves and livestock and how to mitigate the threat that wolves represent to livestock. And what all of that research shows, no matter where it's been conducted in the world, no matter who's conducted the research, you know, over all the years, is that responding to threats by wolves to livestock require that the response be timely and precise. You have to be on the ranch or the farm where the loss has occurred. You have to be focused on the wolves that actually caused the problem, and you have to stay there until the problem is done. And there are ways of dealing with those livestock losses in that kind of precise, focused sort of way. And if they're dealt with in that way, the problems can typically be solved. And again, hunting just doesn't have those properties of precision or timeliness. Most livestock losses in the state of Michigan occur months before the hunting season comes around. Most livestock losses occur in late spring and early summer, and then in the later part of the summer again. And so if that's when the livestock losses tend to occur, that's when you have to focus your mitigation efforts. And hunting of wolves takes place in November and December, and so it's the wrong time of year.
I had read that Michigan had a healthy wolf population. I initially thought that must mean there were thousands of wolves up there in the UP. It's not quite that many.
No, it's not. And I don't know the latest numbers on wolves, but it's, you know, it's in excess of 500 wolves. And wolves are a creature that needs a little bit of space, quite a bit of space, actually. And so for the size that the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, the size that it is, there is, in fact, a very healthy abundance of wolves. And so there's no concern, and to go back to the question about hunting wolves in Michigan, the kind of hunting that the Michigan Department of Natural Resources has proposed thus far would not be a problem for the number of wolves. The number of wolves that are here can handle that kind of harvest. The concern, I'm pretty sure, for the most part, is just you shouldn't kill a living creature without a good reason. And it seems as though the Michigan DNR maybe hasn't come up with adequate reasons. And to be a bit more harsh, they've come up with what very well may be fallacious reasons.
You mentioned that the policy battle that's going on right now over the future of wolves in Michigan, their status, could take a number of different directions. For now, hunting is on hold because wolves are back on the federally endangered species list. Is there any piece of this that you're watching that you think might move next?
Oh, I think the thing that will happen next is whatever the United States Congress does. They're likely to take action on that bill sometime in the relative short term. And whether that bill passes or succeeds, that will say a tremendous amount. And so that's the thing to be paying attention to. If any of the listeners are interested, they would, in this issue one way or the other, they absolutely would be interested to contact their representative in the United States House of Representatives to tell them what they think about the matter.
John Vucetich, thanks so much for your time.
It was great to share the time with you.
John Vucetich teaches in the School of Forest Resources and Environmental Science at Michigan Technological University. Vucinich will give a talk on the future of Michigan wolf hunting Thursday at Western's Fetzer Center. On Friday, he'll discuss his research on the wolves of Isle Royale. You can hear WMUK's full interview with Vucinich at our website, wmuk.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.